Alcoholic, I mean I'm the kind of person who always believed that anything that felt good should be done to excess. If it feels good, overdo it. So I've had problems with gambling and food, you know. Women. I remember when I found out sex felt good. I was by myself just like y'all were. And in spite of dire warnings from my mother about a certain part of my anatomy rotting off and I was going blind, I figured I'd keep on doing it till I was nearsighted. And I did. It's one of my first successes in life. Then I found out it felt good with somebody. And all hell broke loose. I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean I'm a great starter and a poor finisher. At two basic speeds, you know, full speed ahead and stop. Doesn't sound like a big problem. Almost killed me, you know. Always wanted to get in there and master it real quick, you know, and be done with it and go on to something else. When it came to getting sober, that was a huge problem to me because I'd go full speed ahead, you know, for help when I was hurting and in pain and suffering of the law was after me. And when things got better, I'd back off and do it again. You know, if you talk to a good golfer, he'll tell you that one of the most important parts of the swing is the follow-through. And most alcoholics I've come in contact with, including me, we're great on striking the ball, but we're lousy on the follow-through. I never like to keep at something. And maybe that's one reason this program works for me, because it talks about practice, practice, practice. Sometimes I think practice might just be the most important principle in this entire program. You just do it, and you do it, and you do it until it becomes second nature to you. And if it becomes second nature to you, your character has changed. And that's what this program's all about. And there's absolutely no substitute for doing it and doing it and doing it, you know? And if you fall down, pick yourself up. But do it. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, and I'm old school alcoholism, Margaret, when I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean I live in a body that won't handle alcohol. And I found out it won't handle other mood-changing chemicals either. Not any better. Every time I put alcohol in my body, I got a clear message from my body immediately, and the message went like this: Tom, get some more of that stuff and get it right now. Do y'all understand that? Now, some people say that that's because I have a biochemical genetic disorder having to do with the hypothalamic control center in my brain. And others say that the acetaldehyde, which is formed when I ingest ethyl hydroxide, is converted into tetrahydroisoquinoline in my brain, and I lose control. Alcoholics Anonymous says I'm allergic to alcohol. Take your pick. I like to keep it simple. Now, along with this body that wasn't handling, I had a mind that kept telling me I could. That's a problem, you know. You know. And say, this time, if you handle it right, you're going to be able to drink like everybody else. And that in and of itself was a lie, Joe. I never wanted to drink like other people. I didn't understand social drinkers. They're a bunch of idiots as far as I'm concerned. These are the people in the world that call me an alcohol abuser. That's their term. I hate that term. It's backwards. You know? These people go to these cocktail parties. You ever thought about that word cocktail? That's interesting, ain't it? And talk about us alcohol abusers while they take good liquor and start putting mess in it. Put Sprite and Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and orange juice and you know, anything, milk. Then they put vegetables in it, you know, celery, onions, olives, all this other. Then they put fruit in it, squirt whipped cream on it, stick an umbrella on top of it with a straw in it and suck it. Now, when you take good liquor and put all that mess in it, that is alcohol abuse. And if you suck it through a straw, you don't know what it's for. I don't know about you Georgia boys, the way I drank, top came off the bottle, it didn't go back on. And when that was gone, I got me another bottle, you know. I knew what alcohol was for, and I used it for that purpose and that purpose only. Dr. William Silkworth says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I loved it. So I had a mind that kept telling me I could do something I couldn't do because it made me feel so good. And they come in this program and they say, I'm spiritually sick. You know? And I've got a problem with that. And I don't understand that. For a long time till they start looking at me. See, I'm an idealist and a perfectionist, a hypersensitive, romantic dreamer. And I've never been satisfied with life or self or others the way they are. Always wanted more. And in order to get more, I had to control situations and people and circumstances to get what I think I wanted, you know? And when I did that, people rebelled because they was trying to get their more. And I got ticked off, and they got ticked off, and a great barrier came between me and them. And also between me and God, although I didn't know it. Separate me from you, you separate me from God. I know that now. And this barrier separated me and isolated me and disconnected me. And disconnection is the essence of spiritual sickness. I wasn't connected to man, woman, or God, Joe. I was out there by myself. And I was spiritually sick. And then along comes this beautiful, wonderful program. And it says what you need to do is quit trying to control. And take a look at the things that are blocking you and remove those things. And if you remove those things, you'll be restored to sanity. And if you're restored to sanity, your mind won't tell you that your body can do something it can't do. Now that's simple, isn't it? I admire the simplicity in that. But it went way above my head because I was thinking with my intellect all the time. No, intellectuals do not understand our program. They say we're all drugged out on God. That's the latest book. That's a good high, man. You know? And we don't do this and we don't do that. And when they reviewed the book, the American Medical Association reviewed the book Alcoholics Anonymous when it came out, shortly after it came out in 1939, they found absolutely no redeeming value in that book. Nothing. And so you try to talk to an intellectual about this program and he or she will not understand it. It will boggle their mind. Like you say, you've been sober 28 years, that's a long time, you must be very strong. I said, no sir, as a matter of fact, I'm very weak. And he says, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it. You know? Well, you must have fought hard to win the victory over alcohol. No, sir, I surrendered. Well, it makes no sense. I said, hell, I know it. Well, what else do you do? I go to meetings. Ah, group therapy. No, sir, just a bunch of drunks sitting around talking, mostly lying to each other. And he said, that makes no sense. I said, no, it doesn't. He said, what else you do? I said, I got a sponsor. Aha, a psychotherapist. No, sir, he's a plumber. Doesn't make any sense, he said. I said, I know it. He said, well, what else do you do? So we got this program. He said, ah, the theologians and psychologists got together and laid you out a psychotherapeutic path. He said, no, sir, a bunch of drunks put it together. And he says, that really makes no sense. I said, hell, I know it. And he says, well, how's it work? I said, real good. Isn't that something? Just think about that. You can't understand the spiritual way of life from your intellect. It's absolutely impossible. And you know, what's so weird about God sending the message to drunks through drunks? That's beautiful to me. Well, you know, he chose weird people all the time, man. Ezekiel hallucinated all the time. You remember Ezekiel? Saw wheels and wheels way up in the middle of the air. I saw some of them one time. Jack Daniels will do that to you. Jack makes you see things, you know. That North Carolina stump hole, I saw some awful things. You know? How about Elijah? Man run naked out in the desert. Never shaved, never combed his hair, stunk, you know. Dressed up when he went to town, put on a loincloth. Take his big stick, hit it on the ground, said, "This is what God says," and people listened to him. Who wouldn't? How about Moses? There's a strange one. The Bible says Moses was slow of speech. That meant Moses stuttered, Joe. You hear God say, "Moses, I want you to go to Egypt and get my people." Moses said, I can't go. He said, "You know, I send your brother to do the talking. You're going to Egypt." And I and many others in here found out it does no good to argue with the higher power. Jonah tried that day. Jonah said, "I ain't going to Nineveh. I'm going the other way." He got on the boat and went the other way. You know what happened to him? He got thrown out of the boat. Big whale swallowed him, spit him up. Where do you remember where he spit him up? Nineveh. The message in that is God tells you to go into Nineveh, your ass is going to Nineveh. And people find this strange, and I find this very poetic, man. It's beautiful. You know, for some of us in this room to be sober, I'm serious, 1 minute is an absolute major miracle, Jack. And intellect never accomplished a miracle yet. Never. Now, as far back in my life as I could remember, I was afraid. But I know what I was afraid of. And I was really angry. But I know what I was mad about. And I was guilty all the time, and I had no reason to be guilty I could find. But I felt that way. And people say, "Why?" I say, "I don't know. I just do." You know? Now, I had a lot of reason to be afraid. See, I can look back on my life. I was the ugliest baby you ever saw. My own mama told me that. She said, "Son, I ain't never seen an ugly baby in my life till you was born. You're so ugly, I wouldn't take you out of the house for 6 weeks." Psychiatrist, I told him that one time. He said, "Ooh." "Ooh," he said, "that must have been traumatic for you." I said, "No, sir, I've seen my baby pictures. Mama's right, I was ugly." As I grew up, things didn't get much better, you know. I was one of those skinny little old boys, you know. My shoulder blades stuck way out in the back, and I'd try to compensate by pulling my shoulders around, and my chest would disappear. It was a no-win situation, and Mama made me wear knickers, you know. My leg was this big, and the knicker hole was this big. And it's always falling down. And I hated those knickers, you know. Somebody said to me not long ago, "Knickers are coming back." I said, "Not on me, they ain't." And on top of that, I love freckles as long as they're on other people. But not only I had freckles, but people ain't never had no freckles before. I'm going to tell you. I was always squinching. You know what a little skinny boy looks like squinching with freckles? I was ugly, I tell you. You know? And I always wanted to be a macho man. I wanted to be big and strong and mean like my Uncle Glenn and my Uncle Fat and my Uncle Lloyd and my Uncle Durwood. He was my hero. He still is. Call him Dud. Dud was a motorcycle cop back in the days when they had wore riding breeches and leather spats up to their knees, and he had a harness across here with silver bullets in it. Pearl handle 38 sitting high on his hip, and he squeaked when he walked. Do you know what I mean? Smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion. Man, I tell you, the only time I wasn't scared and afraid and angry and guilty was when I was behind Dud on his motorcycle holding on to him. Even then, I needed a higher power. And I think we need heroes. I think we need heroes. I ain't talking about idols. I'm not talking about graven images that we set up there and expect perfection of so we can tear them down later. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about blood, guts, and bones human beings who get out there and make their mistakes and skin their knees and bust their teeth out and get up and do it again. And I wanted to be macho, and I had a head full of snow-white hair. And all my macho uncles call me Puddinhead. I didn't think it was so funny. Last time I checked the list of macho names, Puddinhead was not on the list. And I just didn't like me at all. And at a certain level, I always felt like a loser somehow. I'm a failure. I didn't know why, but I was a failure somehow. I didn't like me. And so it became very important for me to have you like me. It became very important for me to have your approval and your acceptance, to have from you what I could not seem to give to myself. And I was raised by a mother, God bless her heart, who never gave me any privacy, gave me to believe I was totally incapable of doing anything for myself, and even when I made straight A's, was not satisfied. And this just deepened it, you know. Now, I ain't knocking my mama. Don't y'all get the wrong idea. She's 87 years old, and if I called her tonight and said, Mama, come down to Cartersville, Georgia, I want you to die for me, she'd catch this first bus. I ain't into mama knocking. Okay? But this is the kind of person she was, and I felt it, and it had a maximum effect on me. And so I became a straight-A student in the Royal Ambassadors for Christ in the Baptist Church. I was ambassador plenipotentiary in record time. Okay? I was first in everything I did. I was first with everybody I knew, except one person, me. I'd accomplish one thing, and I'd say to myself, so what? What's next? Once I had the applause, it was over. Let me move on to something else. This is not it. Okay? I didn't have a totally dark childhood, you know. I had some good times, and I have to remember these times, you know. I had some times that were real sweet and nice, and I lived in a little mill community down in North Carolina. It was a beautiful little community, and everybody was family. Where's it gone? Everybody on that block was family. We didn't have the same names, but we were family. And I remember the lady next door. I'll just give you a few instances. Her name was Lena, and she's the best cook on the block, and she's the best eater on the block, and she was fat. Beautiful woman. I used to love to go up and hug Lena. When you hugged Lena, you had a breast in both your ears. And it was the most warm, wonderful feeling in the world, man. I loved to hug Lena. Nothing sexual about it. I don't know what sex was. It just felt good, you know? You know, and I remember old man Lucas would come by the house and pick me up. He's going down to slop the hogs, and he'd put me in that wheelbarrow and ride me down to the hog pen. And while he slopped hogs, I'd catch crawdads and wade in the creek and drink cool water. Just being. Being's the finest thing in the world. Being is what rigorous honesty is all about. I don't know when I stopped being and started pretending, Joe, but it was pretty early. Pretty early. And I had some good times. I used to go to the movie, you know, on Saturdays. Cost me 9 cents. See a double feature Western and two good serials like Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. You youngins have to watch TBS to pick up on this, okay? And some good cartoons, funny stuff, man. Not this monster mess you see now. And these cowboys were something, I'm telling you. Wild Bill Elliott. You remember Wild Bill, Joe? Wore his guns backwards, silver guns. And you draw down on Wild Bill, and he'd spin them around, and he'd shoot your gun out of your hand. See? Cowboys was polite in them days. The last Western I saw, there was guts all over the pasture. You know, everything's got to be so graphic now. It's almost like Wild Bill said, hold that a little further. I don't want to hurt you. You know? And Rocky Lane, any of y'all remember these? And Sunset Carson and the Durango Kid, and my favorite cowboy of all time was Lash LaRue. Called him Lash because he carried a bullwhip. You draw down on Lash, he'd whip that gun out of your hand. Now, Lash was the coolest of the cool when cowboys came around. And I loved him, and I was watching him one Saturday up at the movie, you know, and old Lash run all the bad guys out of town. He's standing up on the roof of the saloon with his hands on his hips looking all macho, you know. And he popped his whip and whistled, and his horse come running by. And he popped his whip again and jumped off on that horse and rode off into the sunset, and tears come to my eyes. I said, damn, look at Lash. And I sat through that movie again and again to see him do that. It was wonderful, you know? And you got to emulate your hero, so I went home, got me a piece of rope, went up on the garage. Told a little boy next door, John Q, had a pony named Beauty. I said, saddle up Beauty. He said, okay. I said, now walk her past the garage. And he did. And I popped my rope and whistled and leapt into the saddle. And when I hit it, you could hear me scream Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I don't know if that was a spiritual experience, but I ain't never forgot it. And 30 minutes later, when I got my breath back, I went to wondering about Lash LaRue. You know, I still wonder about him. Maybe it's his balls we had up here. Well, what I'm saying is, I did have some fun, and I did have some friends and everything, you know, and my outer circumstances were pretty good, okay? But inside was where my problem was. My problem was with me. It was always with me. It always will be with me. And the solution has got to start inside. I know that. I was looking for outer things to fix an inner condition. I don't believe it can be done. I used to sit up in the Cheney ball tree. Y'all have those down in Georgia? And think. That's where I do my deep thinking, up in the Cheney ball tree. I had the most wonderful father ever walked the face of the earth. He's another one of my heroes, probably number one. Loved him. Simple, kind, gentle, quiet, goodest man I ever knew. Bar none. And I think about him, and I think about Mama, you know, and my sister, and my friends, Bill Jr. and John Q. and Martha and Betty and all them, you know, and I'd say, yeah, it's pretty good here. But something's missing, and I don't know what it is. It's like I had an empty spot in front, in the middle of me, you know, and I knew if I ever found what would fill up that kind of hole, as Johnny H. calls it, inside of me, everything's going to be okay. But I didn't know where to look for it. I didn't know what I was looking for, but I did know something was missing. And at a very early age, I began longing, I know now, for God and for connection. I didn't know it then. I didn't know it until long after I was in this fellowship. And one day I got connected. Then I knew. I was 15 years old. I was up in Greensboro, North Carolina on a high school singing trip with my running buddies. I, like so many of you guys, I ran with older guys, you know. These were men of the world. They're 17, 18 years old. Boots and ducky, egghead, junk. It's incredible. Carl, how many of them are dead now? From drinking. And they called a cab driver and gave him $7.50, and he came back in a little while and he had a bottle filled with brown liquid and a label on it said Cream of Kentucky. I'll never forget that. And I said, egghead, what do we do with this? He said, you drink a water glass of it as fast as you can, and you drink a glass of water and you do it again. I took directions real good. I went in front of the bathroom mirror and I watched myself take my first drink, and as God is my witness, I can picture it right now. Whatever it was missing no more. Where there had been an emptiness inside of me, there seemed to be a fulfillment. It was absolutely marvelous. And I said, I found it. I'm never going to be without this stuff again. And that very night, when my friends passed out, I called the cab driver. I gave him 7.50. And I got me a pint of Cream of Kentucky. Okay? That was both beginning and end. But I didn't know it. By the time I'm 16 and 17, I'm being locked up on a regular basis in the Wake County Jail in my hometown, where my daddy's on the Board of Deacons for 55 years and my mother's hostess of the largest Tabernacle Baptist church in town. Son's making the social pages. Out there trying to drink like those people he doesn't want to drink like in the first place. Chasing the illusion again and again. Thinking, this time, if I just handle it right, I'm going to find that again and more. I got in a lot of trouble. By the time I was 23, I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking. I was still telling myself that lie. It'll be different next time. I went to psychiatric wards where I discovered that my insanity was not the same as those people's. As I went in the psychiatric ward and being an alcoholic, which is a lot like being a rock lizard, everywhere I was, I wanted to fit in. You want me to be yellow, I'll be yellow. You want me to be green, I'll be green. You want me to say that, I'll say that. You want me to say this, I'll say this. Just please don't disconnect from me. And I tried to fit in the psycho ward. And I watched those schizophrenics. It wasn't long before I could outdo any one of them. I'm telling you the truth. And I got to watching the manic depressive, you know, bouncing off the walls like ping pong balls. I started doing it too. I asked the doctor, what are you giving those people? He said, Thorazine. I said, give me some of that. That's what they give schizophrenics, to clear them up, you know. And for you've seen people in the mental ward walking up down the hall, ain't going nowhere, ain't coming from nowhere. They're just shuffling. That's called the Thorazine shuffling. There I was in line, man, going up and down the hall. Took me a long time to realize this. My insanity was not the same as their insanity. Mine was what the big book Alcoholics Anonymous calls strange insanity. It's not the same. A lot of those fellas, as sick as they were going into catatonic states and into schizophrenic breaks because reality was so horrible, that's the only way they could survive. It was like going into a cocoon to survive. Okay? My insanity was killing me in little bitty steps. My insanity was intensely spiritual, not mental. My insanity was of this. I was separated from what I must not ever be separated from. Okay? I don't know if that's clear to you, but maybe you can think on it for a while. But think with your heart. Our book never says that we're schizophrenic, bipolar, or mentally ill in the traditional sense of the word. It never says that. It says we may be able, intelligent, friendly people who are entirely normal in every respect, but when it comes to alcohol, we are strangely insane. That's what it says. And I believe that. And it's a suicidal, self-destructive insanity. I look back on my life sometime and I am sure that if anybody in this world had treated me as bad as I treated me, I would have killed them. And I tried that, and I tried religious homes for alcoholics, sang in a gospel quartet, called ourselves the Four Roses. Sang around at churches, raising money for this place. Treatment was preaching on Tuesday night, Thursday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Sunday night, and the people from the surrounding churches would come in to... You ever feel like a goldfish in a goldfish bowl? The people from church come in and stare at us on Sunday while we testified. You ever hear a bunch of alkies testify? Good God Almighty. You ain't heard nothing yet. You know, go to an AA meeting if you want to hear it. It's like a game of Can You Top This? We was good. Brian B. was up there with me. He sang in that quartet. And some of us were sober, but by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'm still telling myself that lie, and I'm dying. And I know that I'm dying. You know, at a certain level, I know that I'm lying to me. But it's like parallel with my sound reasoning, said the big book, ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. And here's James in that non-conference approved book again that said a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. It's a peculiar form of insanity, says the big book. Sure is peculiar, isn't it? You know? And I was sure as hell unstable. And about to die. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous first when I was about 23. And sometimes I say I don't remember how, but I do. I was up at Mom and Daddy's house, laid out drunk. And my mother went down to the local florist. His name was Simon. He's dead now. And Simon was happy that day. And Mama said he had a medallion around his neck. And she said, Simon, what's that? He says, Miss Brady, I'm an alcoholic, and that's my medallion. I've been sober 5 years. She said, "That's wonderful, Simon." Simon said, "Well, I stay sober by helping other people. If you ever know an alcoholic I can help, just let me know." Mama said, "Come on, Simon." And I went to Amy. Now, mind you, I am an intellectual. Do you understand that? Okay? With a near-genius IQ, which I tell you about real often. I was so smart, I damn near died, you know? I'm one of those sicker drunks, you know? And I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look on one side of the speaker, you know, and there's 12 traditions on a plaque and 12 steps over here, and the guy up front had a blue book in front of him, and everybody's paying attention to him. He was in control. See, I've always liked control. Any of y'all like control? Don't lie. Don't lie. If I pulled the bus of life into this room tonight, everyone in here would go for the steering wheel. And I'm not leaving you Al-Anons out neither. You know, I had this thing with control, you know. And I wanted to be up front and in control. That's the only place I ever felt comfortable, Joe. So I said, all I got to do is memorize those steps, memorize those traditions, memorize what's in that book, and they'll put me up front and they'll listen to me. And I went to memorizing. And I can quote great portions of that book to you, but it's a relief that I don't have to anymore. But if you're ever in a discussion meeting with me, don't misquote the big book. And they put me up front. And I delivered some of the windiest dissertations you have ever heard in your life. And I had it up here, y'all. Oh, Lord, I knew it. I could spit it out like memory verses, huh? And for the next 7 years, the longest I ever stayed dry was 89 days. You got that? And I knew it. And it frustrated me. And it made me hate myself worse and feel more like a failure. So, my God, I can't even fit in with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even belong here, for crying out loud. It hurt. I was that close to the switch, and I couldn't reach it. And the reason I couldn't reach it was because I was trying to reach it. And I must point out to you, this is a we program. We talked about those steps tonight. We didn't say I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. We said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And we is the basic word in the spiritual life. My sickness is I. My recovery is we. I must never forget that. But I didn't know that yet. You see, I hadn't discovered that. I hadn't got sick enough to shut this monkey off up here. Oh, I did it all. I skipped over the steps like, you know, cafeteria style. I'd prayed a lot, you know, when I got down to 11. I knew all about that, and I figured I'd meditate a little bit. I like that, you know, that's kind of weird. Found out the best meditators, these guys that shaved all the hair off their head and wore orange bathrobes and crossed their legs up and sat down and chanted. You know? And I wasn't interested in the discipline. I was interested in what they could do. These guys could lay on a bed of nails. You know? They could walk over hot coals. They could get hung up with hooks in their back. You ever seen them? That's what I wanted to do. I didn't care about the process. It's like a lot of drunks come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't care about the 12 steps. Hell, they want 28 years tonight. I wanted people to say, look at Tom. He can walk on coals, man. And I looked around, couldn't find an orange bathrobe anywhere. And I'm too vain to shave the hair off my head. And by this time, I'd wrecked so many cars and broken my legs so many times, I could get into lotus position, but I could not get out of it. But you're an alcoholic, you got to do it right, you know. So my wife would help me, and I'd put on my old dirty blue terry cloth drinking liquor bathrobe with the cigarette burns in it. Y'all probably had one. And I'd squat down there and say, And on the calendar, I had a red poker chip pasted on that 90th day, Joe. God, I wanted a red chip. That's what we give for 3 months up in North Carolina. I wanted it so bad I've been up after meetings and stolen them out of the chip box. That's the truth. And I had me one pasted up there, man. And I sat there and meditated, and I've learned this about God. Don't know much about God. Don't have to know much about God. Just love God. You have to understand God. Did I say that? He's got a whale of a sense of humor. I can see him now say it to Peter. There he is again. Peter says who? He says, Pudd'nhead. See, he's sitting down there in that nasty bathrobe again. I wish he'd burn that thing. And tell me, Peter, what does ohm mean anyway? Old Putin's wanting a lightning bolt, you know. He wanted to get real spiritual real quick. You know, he's jealous of Bill Wilson. And on the 89th day, the 90th day, I rested. And I'm going to tell you, it's funny. And I have to laugh at it. I think one of the major practices in this program, one of the major principles probably is humor, although we don't say it. I have to laugh at it. It was absolutely horrible. I'm out in the college out there finally, and I'm studying to be a Baptist preacher. I mean, hell, that's the last resort. And I'm studying theology, and I'm reading philosophy, and I'm studying Greek, and I'm studying Hebrew, you know, and I'm trying to understand this thing. I started meeting some hateful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're all ugly. They're profane. They're dumb. And they call them old timers. Example. One old boy up in Burlington, North Carolina, his name was Bill C. I called him Grumpy. I hated his guts. Man was inordinately stupid and ugly. I mean, I'd come in the meeting, he'd point his finger at me and say, "How you doing, boy?" I didn't like that. I'd give him a standard alcoholic answer, "I'm fine." And he'd take that finger and point back me into the corner and tell me how I was. That scared me. It's like he had X-ray vision. I don't like that. Look at my outside, please, world. I'm not letting you see what's inside. And he could see it. He talked in circles. Say, boy, you can't think your way into good living. You got to live your way into good thinking. And I think to myself, shut up, you old bastard. But I never said it out loud because I was scared of him. You understand? I didn't ever back talk him at all. But boy, inside, I gave it to him, man. I gave it to him, you know. Boy, how come you always run around looking for God? God ain't lost. Oh, I love that one. I tried to impress him every chance I got, you know. Sitting in a discussion meeting, it'd come my term, which was usually last. I'd say, "Paul Tillich said so-and-so." And he'd turn around and say, "Shut up, boy." I used to call him when it was too late. That old man tried hard to help me. I called him when it was too late. You know, test pattern's gone on TV and all the booze is gone. I decided I needed help bad. Called him one morning about 3 o'clock in the morning. Before I could say a word, he said, "Don't ever call me again drunk." He said, "As a matter of fact, don't ever call me again." He said, "If you want to get sober, you know where we meet. Don't call me to come get you. You can walk. Frankly, I don't care if you ever get sober." I already told you I sensed it. Ooh, I said some bad words about him. And tonight, I bless him. I absolutely bless him. And some of these old dudes don't ever change. And he was one of my heroes, Joe. Bill Crumpler. Last time I saw him, he was dying with bone cancer. I'd been sober 18 years. I walked into his hospital room and up came the finger. And he said to me, "Boy, you'll never make it." God, I miss that man, you know. I am here tonight, and I hope y'all don't forget this, because of people like him. See? And as long as I'm walking around, they ain't dead. I want you to understand that, too. They ain't dead. Everything I know, they gave me. I didn't like it when they gave it to me, because I was too smart. But as I've dumbed down a little bit, I've begun to like it. You know? On or about July 20th, 1965, I came to. And I said to me, you can't drink. And you can't quit either. Finally, I realized the other side of the problem. I couldn't quit. And I may at some level have understood what powerlessness was all about. Because if you can't do it and you can't quit doing it, you're powerless. And I knew I was going to die. I was a college professor. I was about to lose that job. My wife and daughter were gone again. See, I had become so caught up in alcoholism that when I felt a drunk coming on, I would go out and buy my wife and daughter presents before I got drunk. Because I knew there was nothing I could do about it, and God help them, they knew it too, and they knew what was coming. When it was upon me, it took me. And I was helpless. I'm on 5 years probation with a 2-year active sentence on the chain gang hanging over my head. I can't drive, never supposed to drive again in the state of North Carolina. And I made a profit out of Grumpy. I walked back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Had it been up to my mind, I'd never come back. See, I had tried AA. See, but AA is not something you try. Try is a weasel word. AA is something you do. Do is an action word. Y'all got that? And I went late and I left early. And I sat on the back row. And I didn't say anything to anybody. I didn't figure they wanted to say anything to me. And then they started talking to me. They said things like, we're glad to see you. We need you here. We love you. That made me shiver all over. And I thought to myself, if they knew me, they wouldn't say any of those things. Because they're talking to the rottenest human being on the face of God's earth. The greatest failure to ever hit the planet. But they kept saying it. Then they found out I was walking. In the first 2 years I was sober, I went to a meeting every night to my recollection. And I never walked again. I got 6 and 8 phone calls a day from people I hardly knew, Joe. They call it group sponsorship. That's another thing we need to take a look at today. The group guys, they call me. You going to a meeting? We're going to a meeting. You want to go? You know we're going over here. Come on, we'll be by and get you. And my sponsor, you know, would pull up in front of the house in his Continental, you know, with his cigar out the window. And my wife would say, he's here. I'd say, who? She said, the Lone Ranger. That's what she called him. She hated my sponsor. Until she got an Al-Anon, and then she hated him worse. So I went to meetings, you know. I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. I didn't think either. I just went. I did what I was told. God, we underrate that. You know, we ask a guy to write a 4-step in 3 days. He can't even find his butt with both hands in 3 days. And so it's reasonable, isn't it? What AA says is very wise and very profound. Don't drink and go to meetings. Why? Because that's all you're capable of doing. Do all you're capable of doing. I'd get real bent out of shape with me because I'm an intellectual, and Harry would say, read so-and-so in the book. I'd say, Harry, I can't read the second line without forgetting the first line. And he said, Tom, you can't read but one line. Read one line. You have been demanding more of yourself all your life than you're capable of giving. Why don't you cut yourself some slack? That's a new idea. Man, I kept going, you know. I didn't know why. I just wasn't nowhere else to go. And I got watching this guy in the group, and he had good eyes on him. Oh, Lord, he still got good eyes. Harry's got Alzheimer's now. And I saddled up to him one night, and I said, I don't want to die. Will you be my sponsor? And he pointed his finger at me and said, boy, I've heard about you. He said, they tell me you're not just an alcoholic. They tell me you're crazy. He said, but I'll help you on one condition. I said, what's that? He said, we'll do it my way. And I don't know but one way, and it's in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, yes, sir, please. I said that. Momentarily, the arrogance was gone. You ever notice how a sponsor seems so erudite and wise until you ask them to sponsor you, and then they go dumb on you immediately? That's what he did. He went dumb on me. He said, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to come to meetings early. I want you to shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. I said, I don't want to come early. I don't want to shake your hand. I don't care how they're doing. I just don't want to die. And why do I have to do that? And he said, you don't ask me why. You do what I tell you to do. Lord God. People come out of these treatment centers and they've had a counselor in there, you know, and they confuse a sponsor with a counselor. Ain't the same. Ain't the same, man. I got a master's degree in counseling. I hope that impresses you. If it doesn't, that's tough. But if I told you to go to meetings early and shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing, my next question to you would be, how does that make you feel? My sponsor didn't give a rip how it made me feel. Matter of fact, he was saying things to me that today make ultimate sense to me. He said, if you go through the motion, the emotion will follow. Effort, result, effort, result, effort, result. Do it, do it, do it. God, I hate it. I did some things he told me to do just to prove him wrong, and he was never wrong. I went to shaking hands, staring at the floor and the ceiling and the walls, anywhere but at you, you might see me. Mumbling. A few weeks, I saw some ankles. I saw some shins and some knees. Yeah, a few more weeks, I saw some eyes. And I was looking at those people, and I was glad to see them. And I did care how they were doing. And I knew they did too. And the hole filled up. You know, I had arrived in the we. I didn't know it, but I'd connected. Lord God, I'd connected. If I'd have known how to do it, I'd have messed it up. Do you understand what I mean? If I'd known what I was after, I'd have missed it. Honest to God. It's like when a human being is whipped into a state of desperation. Like that little drowning man that the big book talks about. And he reaches out for that flimsy reed. My God, he finds what he's always been looking for. When he gives up. I didn't know all that. I ain't sure I know all that now. You know? But a transformation began in my life. I don't mean a small transformation. I'm talking rebirth, y'all. I'm talking about that old person that I used to be, you know, the great pretender. He began to disappear. He's still around. On a given day, he's still around. We don't get perfect in this program. Don't expect that. But he doesn't play the role in my life that he used to. He began to die away. You know? And it's like a new little old baby come into being. You know? Starting all over again. That's a beautiful idea, isn't it? Getting a chance to start all over again. You know? And go on to Nineveh if you're told to go. And I just didn't get a thunderclap, Jack. I mean, I'd have ruined it if I had. What I got was little nudges. Like I was sitting up at the college one day eating my bag lunch, and all of a sudden I realized I hadn't wanted to drink in over 3 months. And I sat there and I bawled like a baby. And I went in a little chapel down at St. Simon's Island, and I was sitting there after I'd taken my seventh step, and it was incredible. I looked up at the stained glass window above the altar. And there was a picture of the carpenter, but there was no cross. And I said to myself, it's just me there. Where's the cross? And the thought came into my mind immediately. It's been removed, Tom, and yours has too. I'm talking powerful, but small stuff, you know. Just little nudges every now and again. And people saying to me on campus who never even knew I had a drinking problem, I don't know what's happened to you, Tom, but you've changed and I like you. You know? And then the president of the college found out I was sober and tried to make a vice president out of me. Wanted to send me back to school and get a PhD. You ready for that? I wasn't. You know? Things happen. I began to listen and I began to learn. I began to understand that freedom doesn't mean being in control. Freedom is giving up the need to control. When I'm driving the bus of life, I'm too busy to enjoy the ride. If I let God drive the bus, go to the passenger section, kick back, I'm free. It's a novel idea, isn't it? And I learned from my heroes in this program, I can't control what happens to me, but I can choose my reaction to it. And it's the reaction that makes the total difference. I believe that. The Buddha said reaction is the supreme art of life. And I believe that. Okay? And I've learned some other things. I learned what love is finally. It's not a matter of rising hormones and emotions. It's romantic love, you know, which has been romanticized all out of proportion. People's hormones rise, you know, and their emotions get high, and they get married, and when the hormones drop and their emotions drop, they get divorced. That's when the loving's got to begin. Because real love, I've learned in this program, is responsible behavior toward my brothers and sisters based on care and respect for them and for what they believe and are and do, whether I like them or not. My sponsor taught me that. I asked him the difference. Y'all always talking about you ain't got to like them, but you got to love them. He said, pick the man in the room you can't stand. That was easy. He said, now if he calls you at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning and said he's about to take a drink, what would you do? I said, I'd tell him to hang on. I'll be right over there. He said, then you love him, Tom. You can't stand him, but you love him. Okay? You transcend feelings. And you do what God does. No conditions. You just do it. And that daddy of mine, you know, beautiful man. I hope to God I'm like him someday. Now, he died with lung cancer. And it was an ugly kind of a thing. I remember when I was 18 years old, the judge had given me an ultimatum, you know, either go to jail or go to service. And I got real patriotic. And I joined the Air Force. My daddy took me down to the bus to go away to the Air Force, and while he was telling me how much he loved me, and always knew he did, he had his hand on my butt pushing me on that bus. He wanted me out of there. I was about to drive him crazy, you know. You know, the day before he died with that cancer, we got so close after I got sober, and he was so pithy and down to earth and everything. He went with me one night, and I picked up an AA chip, and everybody was hoorahing and everything, and we driving home. Daddy never had much to say. He said, son, what were they all clapping for? I said, well, I've been sober, I think it was 5 years. He said, I've been sober 74 years. Ain't nobody clapping for me. I mean, you know, it had a way of putting it in perspective, Margaret, you know what I mean? He was just beautiful. But the day before he died, he turned over and he asked me, was he going to die? And I told him, yeah. He wanted to know when. I told him what the doctor said. And I said, it's going to be soon. And I said, are you frightened? And he said, certainly. But he said, I learned a long time ago, when you're afraid, you give the fear to God and go on about your business. And then he said to me something which is the most precious thing that will ever be said to me. He said, son, he said, I love you. You're one of the finest men I have ever known in my life. Now, there could be nothing that is any higher compliment to me than the human being that I love most in all the world to recognize the change that God has brought about in the one that he loved the most. That's fantastic. And I've learned a little something about this thing called serenity. You know, not much. But I've learned kind of to be comfortable in life and to take life, you know, and don't let it take me. And kind of go with the flow. And greatest of all, I've learned a little bit about how to be comfortable with the person I never was comfortable with before. Me. I can be alone with me for days at a time now, man, and I couldn't stand it before. It doesn't sound like much, does it? I even kind of like me a little bit, you know? And it's so beautiful. And I keep harking back, you know, I remember in the Baptist church we used to sing an old hymn that kind of is where I am right now most of the time. It said, when peace like a river attends my way, or when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, you have taught me to say, it is well with my soul. And it is, and I thank you.